I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Thomas Jones. Today I'm talking to Michael Wood, an emeritus professor at Princeton and contributing editor at the LRB. He's the author of many books on Yeats, Nabokov, Stendhal, Hitchcock and Empson, among other subjects. He has also contributed more pieces than anyone else to the London Review of Books, nearly 400 of them at the last count. His most recent book and his most recent piece are both on Marcel Proust. The piece is a review of two translations of the first volume of À la recherche du temps perdu, Swan's Way, translated by James Grieve, and The Swan Way. We can talk about pronunciation maybe a bit later, translated by Brian Nelson. Hello, Michael, and thank you very much for talking to me today.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Proust's novel, you write at the start of your piece, is founded on a gesture so famous that it's hard to retain the idea of its risk. It's also so famous that you take the risk of not saying what it is, though in your last paragraph you do refer to the Madeleine episode, in which the narrator is, as you put it, too preoccupied with the evocation of his complicated feelings to get far in understanding them. The episode is also so famous that it's sometimes misremembered by readers or by people referring to it, who may mention the Madeleine but neglect to mention the tea. So maybe to begin, you could tell us what happens with the Madeleine and the tea, and why is it a risky gesture?
Okay, the thing that many readers, even good readers, actually ignore, is what I was basing the piece on, in a way, is that this event might not have happened. Since any event might not have happened. But the Proust goes out of his way to underline the ways it might not have happened. And we tend to, all of us tend to overread that, because the story, the traditional story, is a man who'd lost all faith in anything, lost all idea of how to write, how to believe in anything, dips a Madeleine. In earlier drafts, it was a piece of toast, but it became a Madeleine, dips a Madeleine in a cup of tea, and is overwhelmed by a sense that life has changed for him, and that everything that he thought was difficult is easy. The whole world is there, and he has access to everything, and everything is cancelled by this event. And then seven volumes later, he has another series of episodes like this. He trips on a paving stone. He hears someone sort of knocking on a door. Three or four of these things, and they all come together. And so the time frame would be of the Madeleine and the time frame of seven volumes later, that is, in actual writing time, 14 years later, it's the same moment. Within months, the narrator has had this extraordinary experience of invasion by something that cancels time for him, allows him to know who he is, and allows him to feel, as he says, immortal. And at one point at the end, he says, one of my favorite lines in the book is the narrator says, after he's listed three or four of these events, picking up, you know, seven volumes late on the Madeleine in the first one, he says, it was as if chance wanted to help me with these things, as if life was engaged in piling up these experiences. Well, because the person who's doing the piling up is A, the narrator, and B, Marcel Proust. But the striking thing at the beginning, and the thing that people tend to misread, except people like Chris Prendergast, who's a very good reader of this kind of skepticism in Proust, but is that and the detail is quite wonderful. The story of the actual story of the Madeleine, as in the version in Swan's Way, is the narrator comes home on a cold day, and his mother says, "Would you like a cup of tea?" And he says yes, although he usually would say no. He doesn't like cups of tea. He says yes. At this point, a maid comes in and offers him a Madeleine as well, and he says no thanks. And then he changes his mind, dips the Madeleine in the tea, and everything happens. So, but my question always reading this is, what is Proust doing when he's so clearly setting up this event as a non-event?
I did something I never do. I said no, and yet.
Yeah. I said no, and then I changed my mind. Or supposing his mother not at home when he came in, or whatever, you know, there are like dozens of things there, and he's insisting both, I think, on the weirdly random chance. That's why I started with the notion of chance, weirdly random chance question here, and the sense that it's sort of inevitable and it's the secret to the whole story. So it's a bit like a sort of Aladdin or Aladdin's cave or something, where suddenly there's an option for the genie, for the lamp not to work or something. And then so you shake the lamp and it does work. Okay, fine.
Yeah. And whether or not he does dip the Madeleine in the tea, which his mother gives him, and as the dissolving crumbs in his mouth brings back, or he says it brings back, this memory of when his aunt used to give him a Madeleine dipped in tea. Right.
Yes.
But that, I suppose the other thing about this, it's maybe too easy to read there's a sort of a metaphorical force to it, that somehow the Madeleine soaking up the tea or dissolving in the tea is like the narrator's mind sort of plunging into memory and dissolving in the past, or that. Is that the kind of reading that it would be open to, or is that?
Oh, no, absolutely, Tom. I think that really works well. What's happening here is, to put it a bit too simply, is that the narrator and, to some extent, Proust himself, have given up on the conscious mind and on the world of intention and design. So they haven't got anything else except chance. But, and not just because chance won't help, but because the mind, the conscious mind, is of no help. It's good for some things, it's good for practical things, but it will not save your life or make you feel immortal. But sense will do that. So in this case, taste. Could also be smell, could also be hearing. But as well, all of these moves, the memory moves, the thing that produce the magic, they circumvent the intelligence and the conscious mind, which has been getting in the way. So it's a kind of rather beautiful, very dramatic sort of story against the conscious mind and against the intelligence, which fortunately are not all we have.
And doesn't he try to chase the memory? The memory, the sort of has this sort of sudden, yes, involuntary memory, yeah. and but the more he tries consciously to pursue it, the more it gets away from him.
Yes, he gets worried about it. The more he tries, he gets worried, so I can't do this anymore, I'll lose it. And then there is a kind of conversation, it's never quite settled in the whole book, about how the main sort of magical story is that this is a wonderful event. It restores the past to you in the present, right? Because it now is when you're eating the Madeleine or touching the Madeleine, dipping the Madeleine in the tea, but then is also now. Well, now is also then. That's the magical thing. But actually, there are quite a few moments in the book where actually a memory is very painful and there's no redemption. It's just horribly vivid. And so it's not always great when the past comes back. So there's a kind of magical story about it coming back, because that's what you want. More than anything, you want the past to come back. But actually, in practice, sometimes the past coming back is pain and disaster. So,
but there's presumably also reason to mistrust this, because it is quite a deliberately written book or series of books, right? It's not as if, I mean, he doesn't claim, it's not a case of automatic writing that, there's a huge amount of self-consciousness and deliberateness in there. So there's a sort of...
He's also aware, he's fully aware, I think, of the irony of writing. The only way to write is with your conscious mind, and the only way to write is intentionally. The only way to be a writer is to somehow circumvent those things. You have to get around them. In an earlier draft for some of this stuff, he talks about remembering truths that we never knew, which is actually unintelligible in a way, but it makes a sort of sense. How could you remember something you never knew? And he loves, in this context, he loves to use the musical metaphor. So he will say, at one point he says in that passage, the beautiful things that we shall write, if we do write them, are like a tune that we can't properly remember. We can't hum it, we can't sing it, we can't note it, we don't know what key it's in, we don't know any of these things. And then if we work at it, what he says is a wonderful sort of lineup. If you hear the tune, if you hear this tune but you can't really get a hold of it, you're gifted. Right? Most people aren't gifted even. Most people don't even hear the tune. But gifted people hear it, but they can't do anything with it. The thing that would allow you to do something with it is talent. Talent is different from being gifted. And talent means you work at it. Talent really means work. So that when you work on this tune, you couldn't really remember, and you sort of recover it, and then you're in a condition to hum it and sing it. And that's what he says he's doing, essentially. And the other thing that's nice in this context is that memory place, the place of the childhood and the place where he learns about Swann and so on, he tells it twice, once before the memory experience and once after. As long as he hasn't had the memory experience, the only thing he remembers about the past is the time when his mother wouldn't give him a come and kiss him goodnight. And he says, actually, this is brilliantly pictured. There's a graphic novel version of Proust where he says at one point that the whole house was just two floors and the staircase. Downstairs, upstairs where I went to bed, and the stairs where my mother would not come up and give me a glance. All there was. And the graphic novel has a picture of this scene, the house with the... It's always a staircase. Then he has the memory, and suddenly it comes back. Now everything comes back to it. It can be naturally remembered outside of his torments, outside of subjectivity. He just remembers what there is. So it's a bit like the first time he's gifted, but he can't get the tune, and the second time he's talented because he's worked on it.
Because you wrote about the graphic novel version. I remember that it's quite soon after I started working at the LRB. And actually, I had a look at it and had a look at some of the pictures that we reproduced. And I had a mild memory event sort of plunged back into my early days working at the LRB.
My feeling about this memory event is that a lot of people find it very strange, but I think it's quite common that the notion of a sense of some kind. And so what Proust is describing is not some weird Proustian thing, but a thing that in a way, something quite banal. You probably got on, but I spent during the war of World War II, I spent a lot of time at an aunt's house because my mother would go and see my father, who was in the Navy. And there was a time up to sort of late 20s when I could turn on a tap in the bathroom, and as the water ran, I was back in that house, totally. Then after a while, I couldn't do it, and it wouldn't work anymore. Well, you probably have something like that, don't you?
Yeah, there are lots of those things, and particularly smells, and you know, I think everyone has it. And I suppose that's what Proust, as you say, the difference with Proust is that he has the talent to turn it to be able to write about it and describe it, that we can, and as we read it, I mean, I suppose one of the reasons it's so famous is it's that recognition, that everyone, to some extent, has a recognition of the event. They read about him doing it, and they think, yes, I know what that's like, but I don't have the talent to describe it. But this question of the present and the past, of course, that Proust himself or the novel itself is now, as it were, receding into the past ever further as we're reading it, that the present of the novel, so there's, as it were, when it was being written and then looking back to the childhood. And one of the ways which the novel is going back into the past, but we're still, I mean, this kind of leaping over time, that you write about this bit in the piece, is we can almost be tracked through English translations of it. You quote from or refer to, I think, six different English versions of the Côte de Chez Swann, beginning with Scott Moncrief in the 1920s, and some of those versions are updatings or revisions of Scott Moncrief. Some are entirely fresh translations. So why so many? Or would it be better to say, why not more?
I think both of those are good. Exactly. And I think I can't think of another writer who's been sort of retranslated in this way. And so it's quite interesting. When the first really new translation of appeared in 2002, the Chris Prendergast volume, each volume had a different, there were seven volumes, each volume had a different translator. So very, a very successful, interesting venture. There was a huge reaction from many people on behalf of the Scott Moncrief saying, how dare you? We've already got a great translation of Proust. What the hell is this about? And that at that point, that idea, I think, well, then those notions, you only do one translation. And if you don't need another one, don't look at one. I think the ground has changed now, I think. No, I don't think people would say, or a publisher wouldn't say now, we don't need another translation. You would say, well, what would be interesting about it? And why is it good to have another one? And I think I discovered this writing that piece. The story of starting was someone at the magazine sent me the James Grieve translation of 1982 of Swann's Way. And that was the idea, I'll just review that. Then we discovered there was a new Oxford thing in the works. Now first volume coming out and six to come. And so suddenly out of nowhere, there's this one going back, one going forward. And at that point, I didn't know there was a new edition of the Scott Moncrief, still not complete, because he's waiting for copyright to flip. And so the last volume is not out yet of the Scott Moncrief. And in between time, there have been two rewritings of the Scott Moncrief. So at this point, there's a whole question of reviewing, say, one or two volumes of translation, suddenly became a whole question, what is going on here? What do we learn from this stuff? And it's exactly your question. Do we not need another translation, or do we need as many as we can get? I did find that, in a way, that stuff quite bewildering what to say. And I found myself saying things like the fact that the difference between translations are not as large as the similarities in many cases. It's not, and also it's, and I learned a lot just trying to figure out some of that stuff, which I think is quite small things. Small differences are interesting, but you can't make a big drama out of them. You can't claim this is the right one or the wrong one. You can say, I'm interested, this is interesting or this is not interesting. But given real choices, and this has changed too, I think at the time, I'm not sure when to date this, but there was a long time when the question in translation was, do we need it? Is the one already? And the other is it correct? How many mistakes does it make? And it was true that translation used to be full of terrible mistakes, really gross mistakes. I used to read, in the 70s, I read a lot of Latin American fiction. And one reviewing practice was to read it in English and mark all the idioms that looked a bit strange to me and look them up. And there's nothing wrong with making mistakes. I mean, everybody makes mistakes, and particularly about idioms, and particularly in a language like Spanish, say, for example, where the same language has got different idioms from one country to the next. So my Spanish is Mexican Spanish, and I can explain, for example, to native Spanish speakers what Mexican idioms mean and how they work, because that's the idioms. So that question of languages is really interesting. But there was a lot of mistakes. You just had to check whether it was correct, and then it seemed okay. Now I think the accompanying those were huge amounts of academic translations which were correct but unreadable. You just couldn't. I mean, that didn't sound like English at all, right? Because they weren't writers. They were just. You know. That's why people like Robert Lowell was important, you know, because he did a book of translations and called them imitations, and he took lots of liberties. And he did. But that's a great question. What are you doing when you translate something? And I think that really became an interesting question. The evidence here, these six different versions, they don't produce any real conclusion. They produce lots of evidence for differences, but nothing that will allow you finally to decide what sort of thing you're looking for and why not have another translation.
Yeah. And one of the things that you say in the piece, which I think is clearly right, is that perhaps we should be collating rather than dividing the English versions. And you also, you quote Christopher Prendergast, saying translation is not a zero-sum game, which seems to be, I mean, that's really important. But before anything else, I mean, it's a form of reading, isn't it? And the way that there are different ways of reading, so there are different ways of translating. And as with criticism, really, that if good criticism opens a text up rather than closing it down, maybe good translation should do that as well, which means making space for other translations and including mistakes, because sometimes mistakes are interesting.
Yeah, I think that's really great. And I think since now that there's a double move, academic translations are better and more fluent and more literary. The world of mistakes has more or less vanished. It's not that nobody makes any mistakes anymore. It's that they're not common and they're not the first thing to worry about. Then there's the whole double theory of translation that Brian Nelson mentions, but it became very common. And it's mainly, in English, it's most famous through the translation from Russian, say, where do you domesticate the foreign language and make everything sound English, as English as you can, or do you exaggerate in a way the strangeness of it so you make sure nobody will ever think that they were really reading English? So there's a kind of double, but one is what's the translator to do? Should the translator make the foreign language sound like English, fluent English, or should it actually retain as much strangeness as possible so we know we're reading a translation, not so? I mean, obviously, extreme versions of both of these things can be pretty bad. But I think every translator needs somehow to negotiate that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I remember John Sturrock, who was one of the translators of the 2002 Penguin Proust. He translated Sodom and Gomorrah, Volume 4, and he was definitely more of the keeping the strangeness. I mean, I think he would have said that you should never let the reader forget that they're reading a translation from French, and that you're doing the reader a disservice and the text a disservice if you sort of lull them into imagining that they're reading an unmediated original, whatever that might be. But I do remember when him describing a discussion or a disagreement that he'd had with his copy editor in the US, that he'd used the word rout to describe one of the Princesse de Guermont's parties, and he was very pleased with this. And the American copy editor said, well, no one would understand this. And they'd like suggested shindig or but I'm glad to say that I think John got his way, because the word rout does appear in that volume, and shindig does not. But anyway, he was of the idea that you have to keep the foreignness in. But that seems to be a less current view now, that Grieve and Nelson, I mean, I know that Grieve is from 1982, but Nelson, as you said, doesn't take that view.
No, and I think it's interesting that Nelson's a good example, because he claims that he's in favor of otherness rather than strangeness, or a certain kind of strangeness rather than the other. But actually, his is actually very English sort of play. And it's very interesting that one of the cases I mentioned in that piece is, if you're translating, say, a negative remark, he no longer had any faith, do you keep that as a negative and turn it into he lost his faith? Or he did not lose? There's a sort of, do you follow the track of a thought, or do you just say which is the best way of delivering the meaning? And I think translators really do disagree about that in interesting ways. I feel the same as John does, essentially. I think but I do see an argument for the other kind, as long as you don't overdo it. I think James Grieve rather overdoes it. But I think I was looking the other day at Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey, you know, and the first line of the Odyssey describes in I don't know any Greek, but I mean, in all other translations, Odysseus is described as a man of many ways, or different versions of the idea of a man of many ways, whatever that means. So. And Emily just translates this as complicated. He was a complicated man. When I first read that on its own, I thought, this is not what I want to hear something. I want to hear the feeling of whatever that many ways is about. This is about John's route. I want to hear this. But then I started to read the book, and I discovered that she keeps the suspense and the movement, the drama of the thing so well that actually I think she made a choice not to offer complicated word moments, but move up the pace. And I was quite taken by that, because I did initially feel the loss of the intricacy of the idea of the man of many ways. But then I after thought, actually, this is moving very well, and it's very gripping. And it doesn't feel English. It feels just speedy and on the ball.
Yeah. And ironically, there's something, I mean, that estranging moment that you begin to read something that was composed as long ago as the Odyssey was. And so you have that man of many ways. It's not English. It sounds like something translated from Greek, ancient Greek. But perhaps we've got so familiar with that way of translating from ancient Greek that actually, in order to create that moment of estrangement, you have to do something, sort of turn it around the other way and say, tell me of a complicated man. And then that, because if it had said the man of many ways, you'd have read straight past it without even noticing. So somehow you have to.
No, I think that's great. And I come to feel really that the question about translation, which is the benefit of having lots of translations and think about this, you think about different languages and what languages allow you to do, and that's always good, which is then you think about cultures and what cultures assume and what they can do. But it's very attractive, I think, to think of quite of making different choices and enjoying quite different choices rather than settling for the one. So one could enjoy a certain kind of, I mean, if I'm thinking about sort of do I want to read a translation that gets me close to the movement of the prose and this sort of thing, I would want one that as possible keeps the vocabulary, keeps the word order, and help me to feel I know something about that book. I like that kind of translation, so it would be that line. Say Lydia Davis would be the best Proust translation of that volume. But also, you could think of something else, as long as it was not too out of control. The translator could have a vision, and it could be an idiom or a language that spoke for itself. It didn't reveal, it didn't point you back to a text. It's like what you just said about the Odyssey. It didn't point you back to another text. It creates its own idiom and speaks it. I can see a lot of value in that, although it's sort of heresy these days.
I suppose, of course, but the nice thing is as a reader, that in the end, that if you are a translator, you have to make a decision about a word and about word order. You're limited to these decisions. But as readers of translations, we can have it both ways or every way, that there are all these different translations, and we don't have to decide. It's a sort of...
Yeah. I think it's a bit true. There's a wonderful, one of my favorite versions of this thing is in the last volume of Proust, in the translated by Ian Patterson for the Prendergast edition. He translates a word which no one has ever known what to translate. So it's a word that Proust had invented called paparole. And paparole were the bits of, he had this manic desire to keep writing and create. And so he would write something, get it typed, and then type and add it, the endless amount of it. Then he'd get the proofs. He would write on the proofs and so on. And when he'd written all over the proofs and there was no more space, his housekeeper would give him little bits of paper that he'd stick to the page, and he could write on these bits of paper sticking to the page. And she called, I think she invented the word, she called them paparole. Ian translates this as manuscribbles, which seems perfectly sort of, it catches the event and the thing, but it's not the same sort of joke as the...
Yeah. And I suppose it's a joke that you get, I mean, you can see whether or not you know the paparole or not.
See, I think you know. I think you do without the paparole, because it's an invented word and it's related to, you know, it's both the manuscript work and it's scribbling.
Yeah, I mean, and that question of those moments of surprise or strangeness when reading. I mean, this is probably an incredibly naive or gauche or something question, but one of the strangest things about Swan's Way to me, was when I first read it, is the structure of it, not in the sense the movement between the present and the past that we've talked about already, but I think you describe it as an insertion. But when I first read it, it seemed more like an intrusion, really, of the story of Swan and Odette, Swan's, that you have this introspective, self-reflective, first-person narration, and then suddenly, almost out of nowhere, you have this impersonal, omniscient, third-person, sort of relatively almost old-fashioned-seeming sort of story that's sort of shoved in the middle of it. And then we sort of you take it for granted now, because there it is and this is the novel and all the rest of it. But it is very odd, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. And I think because at that point when he wrote the book, he didn't know he didn't have the volumes divided. He had the beginning and the end because of what we were saying about the Madeleine, because the Madeleine experience was linked to a series of other experiences. And all he had to do was write the novel in between them, so to speak. And that's why I think the end of Swan's Way has this feeling of failure and disaster. I think we're meant to actually be moved by it and feel that's it. So he can arrive at the surprise of, oh, yes, you remember that Madeleine thing? Something like that didn't happen again. And once I figured out what was happening, I could write this book. You know. But I think one of the things, actually all of the editions talk about this, but the thing that comes after the Swan thing, when he returns to the story, the narrator is a bit older. Now he's in his teenager and so on, living in Paris and so on. And that really belongs in another volume. And he just chopped it for length at that point. So he published that volume as we have it now in 1913 and didn't publish anything else until 1919. And the next, but really a lot of things in that, actually James Green says this in his introduction, a lot of things in that first volume depend on things that really have happened in this, what is now the second volume. Because there was no natural cutoff point for that. And I think the fact of writing a book which has a beginning and an ending with no natural breaks in the middle, plus one isolated separate mini novel is sticking into the whole thing. Right? It doesn't have any shape in that way. And I think you're right about the Swan's Way thing. I don't quite know. I think what he needs is, that Swan story happens before he was born. Before the narrator is born. So he's telling the story about his own earlier years, and suddenly out of nowhere we get this novel, which he has written presumably at some date much later than anything we've seen so far. But it's all hearsay, see, because he's just picked up these stories, everything. He does know Swan, because Swan comes to visit. One of the moving links is Swan is a pain to him, because when Swan arrives, he doesn't get the mother's goodnight kiss. They tell him to go to bed without a good night. So Swan's are kind of the enemy of his peace and happiness and relation with his mother and so on. And he does have this wonderful line, which is that if I thought Swan would have laughed at this, but if I'd known what I later knew about him, I know he wouldn't laugh. He would have understood exactly what I was feeling when the person you love is not in the place where you want them to be. And so it fits in a way, but it's, I think you're right, Tom. It's a very strange move. And I think we only read it now with comfort because we got used to it.
So I suppose that raises the question, you know, of who is the narrator, or rather, what is, and you write about this in the piece, what is the relationship between Proust and his narrator?
It's a really good question. I think, and to me, the question has grown more complicated. I think before I would have thought, look, the narrator is Marcel Proust near enough. Or in any case, it's a consistent person that Proust invented. The more you read, the more you pay attention to the language, I find the more it seems impossible to believe that Proust is endorsing everything that the narrator is saying. Sometimes he's setting him up for a fall. And you can't set him up if you're the person who's going to fall. I mean, you could think that's an earlier self, but then you'd have the writer would be the later self mocking the earlier self. But it might be the gap is large enough for it not to be an earlier self at all, but someone you might have been and someone you could imagine. But she has lots of things with you. And I do think, I say this in the piece, that here the translators, in a way, the more awkward it is, the easier it is to think about that question. The question you ask about who is telling the story, is Proust his narrator and is he not? There is also a wonderful moment, which I talk about this in my book, but not in that piece, where there are two moments where the name Marcel appears, right, in the whole of the volume, where Albertine, both times it's Albertine, she said, oh, my dear Marcel, my dear Marcel. On one of the occasions, the prose said, she said, my dear Marcel, at least that's what she said if we give the narrator the same name as the author of this book. Now, what most critics think is this is a slip. That is, he had many, many more mentions of Marcel. So the narrator was called Marcel, and he took them all out and just forgot to take that one out or didn't get around to it. So it's a mistake. The narrator is nameless, right? And it's a mistake the name appears there. I feel about that one left mention. I think he did. That's true, that he had a name and he took out all the names. I think he left that one there as a deliberate kind of riddle or joke for the same reason as the Madeleine almost didn't happen. If you say, if we give him the same name, that's not an accident. You're not saying we won't give him the name, and you're not saying you will either. you are raising the question that the narrator might have the same name as the author. Of course, it is a kind of brilliant joke. I also think, I say this in the book too, but there's nothing extraordinary about a person being called Marcel in a book by Marcel. There are people called Jane in Jane Austen, for example.
I mean, it's a choice in the comic book version that you've already referred to, that they make the decision that he looks like Proust as well. I mean, that when you see him as an adult, it's a caricature of Proust, but it's that same. And presumably, given the parole and the nature of that, it would be very odd for him to have left it in by mistake, given how careful he was with the previous.
I think so. And all that sort of thing. And the other thing is,
I mean, that question of how he knows things, again, which comes up, there's a scene which you discuss at some length in the piece where he's spying through the windows of the daughter of the composer Vinteuil, and he said it as sort of a bit where just before he says he has to stay and watch because if he tried to leave, she'd hear him rustling the bushes and then she'd know he was there and think he was spying her on purpose, and so therefore he has to stay on spy on her, even though that was never his intention, which is a sort of a wonderfully convoluted piece of self justification. But it's also it's also a joke about, well, how do you know this? How do you, I mean, it's almost could be out of Fielding or something, the kind of, well, how do you, what's your, you know, how do you know what happened? Well, I happened to fall asleep outside the window and woke up just at this moment, and that's how I know. I mean, is that something he does often?
He does it all the time. And I think he doesn't highlight it all the time, but I think many readers don't want to see that. Part of the deal they make with the novel is that the too simple view would be there are writers like Sterne, Fielding, many modern writers who are always interfering or showing up. And Thackeray even does it, showing up in the middle of the other things. And then there are others who will give us our illusion and will never interrupt. They made a deal. They won't interrupt the illusion. And I think that's more a critical fantasy than a novelistic practice. I think most novels, including Jane Austen, and many others, often have those meta moments where the question is, how do you know this? And why could this only happen in a novel and not somewhere else? It happens all the time, I think. And I also think that it doesn't interfere with the illusion. It's actually often helps the illusion to play these games. But there was, certainly for a long time, a standard reading about these things, which meant that you had to respect the illusion and pretend that you had to pretend all of this fiction is fact. And I, the author, got nothing to do with it. I didn't make it up. I didn't even arrange it. So I'm just telling it like it is.
I just happened to look through the window and there it was.
There it was, yeah. I think what's interesting about the story, there's a very good book about Proust by James, what's his name? Joshua Landy, where he takes what used to be the consensus about Proust was that the narrator and the author are identical. That is Marcel, whether he's got the name or not. This is a totally confessional. And the book we are reading is the book that he finally managed to write. When he got to the end, had these connected the later memory experiences with the Madeleine, sat down and wrote his book.
Book that the narrator writes about himself writing is the book.
It's the book that we have just read. Yeah. Joshua Landy, I can't really believe in that reading, but I quite like it. Right? So, and many readers, many generation people, there's still people are divided into two groups whether they talk that way. We have just read the book that the narrator of this novel succeeded in writing, or we have just read a novel which is about a man who wanted to write a novel and who is still wondering whether he will have time to write it. And in any case, if he wrote it, it might well be quite different from the one we've just read, which was written by Marcel Proust.
Which makes him sound like Borges. I mean, it's a sort of...
Absolutely, yeah. And I do think that sense of... It's sort of dizzying stuff, but I think that feeling of... the other thing is what it sounds like. I think it's someone like Philip Roth. You know, we read Philip Roth, Shylock, or all these things. There's a person called Philip Roth in there, but how similar is the person called Philip Roth to the novelist?
So. Yeah, or the Chaucer who appears in the Canterbury Tales.
I just read and reviewed a book about Roberto Bolaño, where the person talks about novel theory being not sophisticated enough, academic theory not being sophisticated enough about this stuff. So there's a kind of interesting exchange where the old model would be. Good old fiction is pure illusion, stays with the illusion, doesn't muck about. Postmodern nonsense messes about and you have to be fancy and silly to do this stuff. Or flip, you know, the old stuff was the old stuff, this is the new stuff. But actually, supposing the division was not so drastic.
So there's an idea that Homer, well, there used to be an idea that Homer was a blind singer.
Yeah.
That idea comes from the portrait of a blind singer in the Odyssey. But the idea that maybe this is a self-portrait, but of course there's nowhere does he say it's a self-portrait, but the idea that people wanted to believe, and they've been wanting to believe that for hundreds of years, that ancient Greeks wanted to have that belief. The idea that these things which are described as postmodern, you can say, but what about Sterne? But what about Chaucer? And then you can go all the way back and say, well, what about Homer? So
yeah. There's a great one in Jane Austen, I think it's in Northanger Abbey, where she says, or maybe in Mansfield Park, where she says essentially, I mean, she says it more elegantly this, but she says the reader will tell from the small number of pages that are left that we're hastening towards felicity. The happy end is in sight. No, it's totally brilliant, but the evocation of the physical book that we're reading and the idea that happy ends are the only truth in a happy end is that the reader wants one.
That's what I'm saying. Don't worry. Don't be too. You know that kind of. Don't worry. Everyone's going to be okay. Yeah.
I do think the idea that I think there's a collusion here between what the author is doing and what the reader wants. Kind of interesting deal. I think it's also very interesting not to settle the matter because I wouldn't want because it's too smart to sort of say oh it's always the skeptical, it's always the complicated tricky one because that's the truth. That's just as naive in a way as saying the old-fashioned illusionistic one was the truth. What's interesting is the fact of do we pause to think about it, or do we skip it this time, or do we come back? You know,
you have both. That somehow both are true at once. You can they're held in.
Yeah. Yep.
Because the other question of whether I mean even to say if it were autobiography, but then again, what I mean autobiography—the idea that you can have an autobiography without fictional elements.
yes,
is impossible anyway. So even if it were autobiography, that doesn't, in a way, that doesn't take you that much further. Is this autobiography or fiction? It's kind of, well, I mean, you can say all fiction is to some extent autobiographical, and all autobiography is to some extent fictional. So it's
And also that you get into this realm. Proust loves this kind of thing, but you enter that realm where things are you know, they're literally, they're not literally true, but they're true in another way. And therefore the only way to make that particular sort of truth available is to pretend that it's true in the other way. So Proust used to go all the time. And I think the more you read him, I think, the more you feel what I used to take to be exaggerations or elaborate metaphors or a little over fancy, feel to me now like the minimum you could do to convey how extraordinary reality is. Because if reality doesn't feel like a crazy fantasy, it's not realistic. So have you looked at the newspaper lately or watched TV?
Yeah.
I don't think Bruce thought that consciously or worked it out, but I do think as a matter of, stylistic practice, that's what he's doing.
I mean, and that whole question of what's done of deliberately and by different ideas of the self. I mean, it's hard to read Proust without thinking of Freud, isn't it? That Freudian readings of him.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's, and he, it's so interesting. He didn't know anything about Freud. I don't know whether Freud knew anything about Proust, but they had a lot of common ground. Proust's father was a doctor who specialized in things like neurasthenia and things like that. Proust was very interested in psychology, which at that moment, the late 19th century, was a branch of philosophy. And so he was very interested in what we're going in and based mental conditions. And Freud studied there. So Freud studied in France. Freud's early work was based on French work. So in a sense, they had a lot of common ground intellectually, which had to do with a sort of what must have felt like a new discovery of the mind as a place, in the late 19th century.
You make a strong case in this piece and, and in your book and elsewhere for Proust's comedy. I think you've even compared him provocatively but persuasively, perhaps one of these sort of moves that he does to Roger Rabbit in the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is... why is Proust like Roger Rabbit? And then also, do you think his funny side is too often overlooked? Yeah.
It's a great question for several reasons, Tom, because someone at Columbia called Elizabeth Ledson has written some wonderful stuff about Proust the comedian, Proust funny, brilliant stuff. But she feels she has to apologize to all Proustians that I'm going to talk about him being funny, and I know I'm not supposed to do this, and it's not really there. And then she demonstrates, she likes to compare him to the Marx Brothers, and with lots of Jewish jokes. And like, I would never want to belong to any club that would admit me and sort of stuff. And it's very good. But the interesting thing is, people have been saying he was funny from the very beginning, and everybody forgets every time. So I don't quite know what the machinery is, but there's the sense is that he was and is funny. But you can't, as it was, say that, you can say that, but it won't last. So it will need saying again.
You remember something that you didn't know was true.
Yes.
That?
Yeah. And I think probably that there is a kind of rear guard snobbery about great writers, a notion that great writers can't really be funny. That's why Dickens is not as good. I mean, this is old-fashioned stuff now. I hope it's old-fashioned. I hope it's gone altogether. But there was a consensus, say that George Eliot was better than Dickens. Because in the end, Dickens was just an entertainer, and she was a philosopher. In fact, she can also be quite funny, too. But the idea that comedy and the idea of tragedies are more important, every Shakespearean tragedy is more important than any comedy he wrote. Deeper, closer to the meaning of life and all that sort of stuff. That's the kind of prejudice, I think, we inherited. And probably it's that prejudice that's making sense. If Proust is the great writer he's supposed to be, he can't be funny.
I mean, and is that more true in the Anglophone world? Or is it the same? I mean, is it true in France as well? Is there an idea that Racine, Molière...
I think it's true in France too, yeah. I think that sort of... if you think again to English fiction like Jane Austen or Fielding, to move towards that genre of comedy saying, I'm going to give you the happy end that you knew you were going to get. So many people just seem frivolous rather than, and not realistic, not vraisemblable, not following the truth in it. in its way. And my sense of how this works is there's a great moment in The Feelings, Tom Jones, where he says something, one of those little prefaces to the chapters, he says something like, there is a theory that in this world, good people are rewarded and evil people are punished. And this is an excellent idea. And there's only one thing wrong with it. It's not true. And then he proceeds to do that in the novel. Now, I think that is as profound as any tragedy, really. But I understand that it seems frivolous to many people. They need to be direct, and people need to say to you, "I'm telling you the truth."
Yeah, very good. Then there's Proust. I don't know. Does Proust have a happy ending? Obviously, the first volume doesn't. But if you know,
that's what's interesting about the ending, because obviously, in one sense, he does, because we are reading a book that someone wrote, whoever he is. But on the other hand, that sense of doubt of I might not have had the Madeleine, I might not have dipped it. If I had the tea, I might not have got the Madeleine. If you had the Madeleine, I might not have dipped it into the tea. And so all of that is still there in the last pages of the book, where he's saying, it's all about time. And that the last sentence is all about, if I have time. He doesn't say, oh, now I finally. There are many times in the book when the time reference is outside the book. You know, things have already happened, historical things have happened, which we know the book is already finished. Right. But the book itself actually ends on if I have time, this is what I'll do. And I find that sort of very moving, since it's, I think Proust did actually, that, I think that is Proust in a way, saying something like, look, I've been an invalid all my life. In the sense, as I've enjoyed being an invalid, it's part of who I am, it's my identity. But I know this is dangerous stuff, and I could die at any minute. And he did, of course, die before the book was published. He died when only three volumes were out, four volumes were out. I think he's saying both, this book is already finished. Enough of it is there, so I'm done. And also, I'll never be done, because this thing can't be finished. And I might be not done in a bad way, because I might die just when I was about to do something different. Because you can't tell.
Yeah. Michael Wood, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read Michael's piece in the 4th of January issue of the LRB, along with James Meek on the new TV, the subject of last week's podcast, Andrew O'Hagan on Robert Louis Stevenson, and Deborah Friedel on Catherine Mansfield. And there's still time to subscribe to the LRB's Close Readings podcast. There are three new series this year, Colin Burrow and Claire Bucknell on satire, including an episode on Jane Austen, Adam Schatz talking to Judith Butler, Pankaj Mishra and Brent Hayes Edwards about some of the revolutionary thinkers of the 20th century, and Emily Wilson and I are back with a new season of Among the Ancients. Go to lrb.me/plus for details. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourne. The music is by Kieran Brunt. I'm Thomas Jones. Thank you for listening.